Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Keith O'Brien, author of Fly Girls, how five daring women defied all odds and made aviation history. And Brad Richard talks about new developments in the South Louisiana Scholastic Art and Writing Awards. It's a great pleasure to welcome Keith O'Brien to The Reading Life. Keith is a former Boston Globe reporter and a frequent contributor to National Public Radio. His works appeared in many national publications, and local readers will remember him as well from his days at the New Orleans Times-Picayune. He's the author of Outside Shot, Big Dreams, Hard Times, and One County's Quest for Basketball Greatness. He's speaking to us today from his home in New Hampshire about his terrific new book, Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. Keith O'Brien, I'm so happy to welcome you back to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you, Susan. It's so great to be here again.
Now, there's such serendipity attached to this book. I just love that you got the idea for it while on a plane. I mean,
I know. Isn't that one of life's great ironies?
It is. Sweet.
Or just perfect symmetry. Yeah, you're right. So I was flying for a story I was doing for Politico magazine at the time, in the spring of 2016. I was going from Boston to Pittsburgh. And for the flight, I had grabbed off of my bedside table one of the many books that sits there as on my stack, and it was Lily Koppel's The Astronaut Wives Club. This book was a story about the wives of the first seven astronauts. And one of my favorite books of all time is Tom Wolfe's The Right Stuff, which, of course, is about the first seven astronauts.
Of course.
So I wanted to read Lily's book just to see how she had done it, how she had told this story that I know so well from the exact opposite perspective. So I'm on the plane. I'm reading her book. I'm on page 16 or so, and there's this paragraph that had some background history on daring women. And there was this line, just one line, about an all-women's air race in 1929 featuring Amelia Earhart. You know, I consider myself fairly well-educated, fairly well-read. I've never heard of such a thing. And, you know, in my day-to-day life, if I had stumbled onto this, I may have written this little idea down in a notebook that I keep in my back pocket where I write down story ideas for books and magazines and NPR. And in this case, I could have done that, but I was stuck in coach on a plane, and it was a plane that had Wi-Fi. And so I was able to open up my laptop and start Googling, start reading about this air race in 1929. And by the time I landed in Pittsburgh, about 90 minutes later, I knew a few things. One, I knew the story was bigger than just one air race. As it turns out, there were lots of air races in the 1920s and 30s. And two, I knew these women were compelling because as I looked at the list of all these competitors, I only recognized one or two. And then thirdly, I just knew that I had to get to a library to really get into it. And that's what I did in the weeks to come. I dug down. You know, I spent evenings, late nights in front of microfilm machines. And I began to realize that this was a story that had been forgotten, and I wanted to change that.
Well, I love the idea of get me to a library. As you know, that's one of my favorite things. Now, one of the things that's so interesting, you know, they always talk about, like, the great invocation for poetry is always make it new. And what you've done is take early aviation history and made it new and made it sing and made us look at it again. I mean, in addition to these women, there are some of the men who, of course, were instrumental in early aviation history, Ben Dix, Cessna, you know. And so talk a little bit about educating yourself about that history.
Sure. So I'm not an aviation geek, and that's a word that some people out there use with pride, you know, to be an aviation geek. I'm not one of those people. I am not a pilot. And so I came from this story from the perspective not as a pilot, but as a storyteller. Like all storytellers do, I was writing about the things that were most interesting to me. I was stunned to learn just how dangerous flying was in the late 1920s. You know, that planes could fail for all sorts of crazy reasons, that at times the wings would just fall off.
Right.
I mean, imagine that. And the wings not only would fall off, but investigators would come in and they wouldn't be able to figure out what had happened. It was fascinating to read the early investigations or inquiries into crashes. These so-called experts, aviation experts, had no idea why planes had crashed, and they would basically say so. So that was one thing I just found so stunning. And I guess the other thing that I found interesting as I got more into it was just how little we know about some of these big names. People have forgotten that Charles Lindbergh didn't just fly across the ocean because he was looking to become a pioneer and looking to do something that had never been done before. If he made it across the ocean alive from New York to Paris, he would get $25,000,
right,
which was a massive sum of money in 1927. And we've also simplified the story of Amelia Earhart to the point that what most people think they know about her is actually wrong. And it was fascinating to see how much we do have wrong about her.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I do love about this book is while you definitely recognize Amelia Earhart, you really balance your treatment of her with four other accomplished women that most of us don't know anything about. And I wonder if you'd introduce us to those women a bit. They offer such a range of women's lives and experience, and yet they're all bound by this great risk-taking endeavor.
Absolutely. So, yeah, my story focuses on five women most of all. One of them, of course, is Amelia Earhart. She was the most famous female pilot at the time. But there were others who were flying with her, who were friends of hers, who were rivals of hers. And they were often just as brave, just as bold as she was. And arguably, at times, they were even more skilled in a cockpit than she was. So, in addition to Amelia, my story focuses on four other women. One of them was named Ruth Elder. She was a flashy Alabama housewife from Anniston, Alabama, who in the late summer of 1927, 8 months before most people had ever heard the name Amelia Earhart, decided that she would become the first woman to ever fly across the ocean. And for this dream, Ruth Elder would pay an awful price. The story also focuses on another Ruth, Ruth mm-hmm. Nichols. Ruth Nichols was the daughter of Wall Street wealth in New York City and in Westchester County, New York. She had money, but she desperately wanted everything that Amelia had and would challenge Amelia in the years to come for the title of most accomplished female pilot. The story also focuses on Florence Klingensmith. She was a young, daring pilot from rural Minnesota who moved to Fargo as a young woman, worked at a dry cleaner's there, but desperately wanted to fly, would get herself in the air, and of these women was no doubt the most skilled pilot. She would ultimately race the men in what was known as a free-for-all race. This was a race around pylons placed on the ground. Planes would be whipped around the pylons, almost like a NASCAR race in the sky. Florence would challenge the men on such a course in 1933. And the final main character is Louise Faden. She was from Bentonville, Arkansas. She got her start in Wichita, Kansas, selling coal, of all things, in the mid to late 1920s, but knew she wanted to fly, made it happen, and then pulled off the ultimate trick of the era. She was one of the few women who managed not only to fly airplanes, not only to race airplanes, but to have a family. Louise Faden would have two children while she continued to race.
I suspect that Louise is your favorite.
I think Louise is a great role model to parents today. Any working parent today, whether you're a man or a woman, knows that we make sacrifices when we have children. And, you know, at times we sacrifice our own ambitions, our own careers. You know, I know personally as a father, I've made decisions over the years in favor of my family over my career. Louise definitely did that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if she had not had children, I truly believe that she would have continued to fly, continued to race, and that we may have streets and schools named after her today. She made sacrifices on the ground so that she could be with her family while also still trying to pursue her dream, which was to fly. And I think that's something that any working parent today can understand.
Oh, absolutely. I have to say, I love Florence Klingensmith, and I didn't know very much about her. And I love so much that her ambition was such a direct reaction to Charles Lindbergh not waving at her. You know, when that
right.
parade goes by and she goes, I'll show him. I mean.
So Florence was working at a dry cleaner's in Fargo, North Dakota in 1927 when Charles Lindbergh flew solo across the Atlantic. And after he made it across and then made it home again to America, he was put on this like 90-city tour across America, paid to do it, paid handsomely to do it. Lindbergh didn't particularly like this tour. He wasn't fond of the spotlight. He wasn't fond of crowds. But he went on it because he was paid to do it. And in the summer of 1927, he would visit Fargo, North Dakota. Everywhere he visited was a massive affair. They would shut down schools. They would shut down work. You know, church bells would go off. Factory whistles would shriek. And then, you know, Lindbergh would parade down the streets and give a speech, and then there'd be a dinner dance that night. Florence was outside the dry cleaners as Lindbergh's car rumbled by, and as you suggested, she waved to him. She wanted to get his attention, and Florence was someone who could get a man's attention. Certainly, she was known to be very attractive, but Lindbergh didn't wave back, as he surely couldn't, as he often didn't. He can't wave to everybody. And she did take it personally and would, as she said, I'll show him that you know, a man can't just do this kind of thing. She would indeed go do that.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that interests me about this book, because we have to go back to that time. And these were women doing something unbelievably new and important, and they had to fight against so, so much. And yet, I think a lot of times the public just recognize them as celebrities rather than for their achievements. You know what I mean?
I do. You know, here's something else we forget. You know, at the time in the late 1920s when the narrative in Fly Girls began, women were banned from doing all sorts of things. They were banned from serving on juries in many states. They were banned from holding public office in some states. They were banned from working night shifts. They were banned from driving taxi cabs. These were laws that specifically excluded women. There was no law that specifically excluded women from flying, but it was clearly not a place where they were welcome. You know, in the late 1920s, a young woman was still expected to get married and have children, and if she were to get a job, it was to be one of just a handful of a couple things, typically. And just to give you an idea of what women were up against at that time, take, for example, school teachers. It was, of course, one of the prominent jobs that were available to women in the late 1920s. But it was specifically stated in many communities by law that these jobs were for single women. If a school teacher got married, if a female school teacher got married, she was expected and sometimes required to quit and give up her job to a single woman, because presumably now, because she was married, her husband would support her. That's what these female pilots were up against. They weren't trying to teach second grade. They were trying to fly an airplane. And it was, in the late 1920s, one of the most radical ideas you could have. In 1928, we are 8 years removed from the women's suffrage movement, and there are roughly 30 million American women who are registered to vote. At that same time, there were less than a dozen licensed female pilots in this country. You know, that made Amelia Earhart and Louise Staden and Ruth Nichols and Ruth Elder and Florence Klingensmith and some of these other women, that made them truly radical, truly revolutionary.
Right.
And they had to overcome so much to do it.
And it's fascinating that even though they were competitors in this culture of air racing all across the country, they also stuck up for one another.
They did. They were absolutely at times competitors. Each of them, you know, wanted to win the races that they were allowed to compete in. Some of them vied against each other to be the first woman to get across the ocean. Those were headlines and prizes that each woman wanted. But they recognized early on that they were all connected, you know, for better or for worse. When one of them would crash or when one of them would die, it was a failure that the men and reporters would attach to all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And when one of them succeeded, the women knew the opposite was true, that it was good for all of them. And so they did stick together. And not only that, Susan, these early female pilots organized. They organized a group of four women pilots by women pilots called the 99s, which got its name because when it was formed, there were 99 charter members. That organization still exists today for female pilots.
And I love how when they realized they were at the mercy of mechanical failure, they learned to fix their own planes.
They did. You know, Louise Staden, who again was from Bentonville, Arkansas, was known to get right in there with the male mechanics and work on her engine. You know, Florence Klingensmith would proudly declare to any reporter who suggested otherwise that she knew how to break apart an engine and rebuild it again. These women weren't just brave and bold and making what was then considered to be radical decisions. They were extremely bright. You know, they were extremely intelligent and were able to do things not only that most women couldn't do, but most men couldn't do.
Right. Now, one of the things about this book that I admire so much, Keith, is that it's such a great adventure story. And you do such an amazing job recounting their races and their travels. Every time somebody got lost or got tired or crashed, I'd find myself exclaiming out loud and talking to the book, saying things I can't say on NPR. I mean, it's just, it's such a thriller in that way.
And it was a thriller to research. I was stunned again and again to see what would happen in these races. In particular, flying was dangerous, but racing was even more dangerous. And again, I'm not an aviation history buff. I'm not a pilot. I didn't know what happened in the 1933 Bendix race or the 1931 Thompson Trophy race. I didn't know. And so, just like readers, you know, when I was sitting in front of these microfilm machines, you know, I was reading about these races for the first time myself, and it was stunning at times to see just how wrong they could go and how disastrous they could be. Let's just be clear, if you crashed in an open cockpit plane in 1930 at a speed of 180 miles an hour, chances are you died. And what was really surprising to see was that the races would go on. Not only would the races continue the next month or the next season, they would continue that very same day, even when someone crashed and died right there in front of the grandstand. You know, imagine NASCAR racing today, for example, or NFL football game. If someone died every other weekend, once a month, that's what air racing was like, and still they kept going.
Right. And yet, to balance all that out, you know, this is a terrific story of women's lives and women's choices and the different paths a person can choose. And I think you do that with great respect as well.
Oh, thank you so much, Susan. I really appreciate that. And, you know, I've been fortunate to have been raised by strong, independent women, my mother and my grandmother. And, you know, I'm married to a strong, independent woman as well. And my wife is always my most trusted editor, my most reliable and sometimes most brutally honest editor. And, you know, she was certainly the first one to read the pages in this book.
Well, I bet she loved them as much as I did. Because it is fun. Such fun to read this book. It's a thrill. We've been talking with Keith O'Brien, whose new book is Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. You can meet him September 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Keith, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Susan. It's such a pleasure.
Brad Richard is the chair of the creative writing program at Lusher Charter School, and he's been instrumental in educating a new generation of New Orleans writers. He's the author of such well-known works of poetry as Butcher Sugar and Motion Studies, and one of his passion projects is the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards competition, which inspires and recognizes young creative folks in our region. And there are some changes afoot this year we want student writers and artists and their teachers to know about. Brad, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Good morning, Susan. Great to be here.
Scholastic is such an old name, you know, and respected name in publishing and education, and it carries a lot of weight. And this competition is especially meaningful for that association, right?
Yes, indeed. So, a brief history. The man who started the Scholastic Publishing Company, Robbie Robinson, decided 95 years ago, if memory serves me right, that there should be an art and writing competition for young people. So it started as a regional thing in the Northeast and very quickly became a prestige national competition with alums including people like John Updike, who actually got his award for cartooning, Sylvia Plath, Truman Capote, and then more contemporary figures like Lena Dunham and the great artist Paul Chan.
Yes.
So it has been a phenomenal program that really does a great job of identifying and nurturing young talent.
So when did it get started here in the Southeast?
So about 10 years ago, after a long time of having students submit work to the Scholastic program and having them do well, I got intrigued and went up to New York for the National Awards Ceremony and was blown away. So I came back wanting to start a writing affiliate, which I did with the Greater New Orleans Writing Project here at UNO. And we have been administering the regional competition for Southeast Louisiana for all that time. But we are very, very excited that two big changes are happening this year. One, we've expanded our region, so we are now all of South Louisiana.
Wow.
And, drumroll, we are adding the art affiliate, finally.
Fantastic.
Very, very, very excited about this.
So describe how this competition works, because it's very organized and there are deadlines.
Yes.
And you have to gather judges. There are all these layers of activity.
Right. So the submission period opens on September 12th. And on that day, students will be able to go to artandwriting.org and enter their zip code and make their way to our submission site. And then they will have from September 12th to December 17th to submit their work. There are many, many categories in both art and writing. So writing includes everything from poetry and fiction to critical essays and journalism. And art includes all 2D media, sculpture, and digital media. And there's also a really cool hybrid category called The Future New. And what they're looking for The Future New is something they've never seen before. So it could be collaborative, it could be just a different way of thinking about writing or visual media. If that intrigues a student, they should check out the guidelines for that category.
So the art students would be submitting photographs of their work online. Am I right?
Correct.
Okay.
Everything is done digitally, all
gotcha.
Uploaded onto our website. And then the adjudication period starts pretty much as soon as the deadline happens in December. We finish adjudication in late January, and then we announce our region's winners. And there are three possible award levels: honorable mention, silver key, and gold key. And the gold key winner's work is then automatically submitted to the Alliance for Young Artists and Writers in New York for national adjudication, where they have the opportunity to be selected as national silver or gold medalists. And the gold medalists will be invited to the awards ceremony next June in Carnegie Hall.
Now, this is a lot of work for you, Brad. So,
a little bit.
Yeah, I know. So what keeps you going? What keeps you plugged into this?
I think just seeing the difference that it has made for so many young people. You know, I'm a teacher, as you mentioned. I teach 7th through 12th grade students, which happens to be the exact age group for Scholastic. And it is so wonderful watching a 7th grader who is incredibly reluctant to submit their work, then if they receive even an honorable mention or silver key, just to see the light go off and to see that, like, I can do this.
Yeah.
This is something I could consider pursuing. It's something I'm actually good at. That is so rewarding.
And that's why you're one of the best teachers I know.
Oh, thank you.
We've been talking with Brad Richard about the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards for South Louisiana. For more information, check out artandwriting.org or the Facebook page for the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards of South Louisiana. Brad, thanks so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Amy Bonifon signs The Wrong Heaven Monday, August 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Vicki Saloom signs her novel, Waiting for You at Midnight, Tuesday, August 7th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop, Saturday, August 11th from noon to 2 at Barnes & Noble Metairie, and Sunday, August 12th at the Maple Leaf Bar at 3. The Garden District Bookshop Book Club discusses Gail Honeyman's novel, Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine, Wednesday, August 8th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Stephen Ray discusses his new book, World Cup Fever, a fan's guide to the stars, teams, stories, controversy, and excitement of sports' greatest events. That's Thursday, August 9th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And it's a great pleasure to announce the winners of this year's Diana Pinkley Prizes for Crime Fiction, presented in memory of the civic activist and Times-Picayune mystery columnist. This year's winner for the Distinguished Body of Work Award is Ellen Hart, creator of two series featuring Jane Lawless and Sophie Greenaway. The winner for debut novel is Marcy Rendon, whose book is Murder at the River. The awards will be presented Saturday, October 6th at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation. For more information, check out pinkleyprizes.org. Join us for the Tricentennial Reading List every Tuesday at 8:44 a.m. and 5:44 p.m. The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Hellas Foundation, the John Burton Harter Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.